I'd like to call to order for the March 3rd, 2021 meeting of the TPA Citizen Advisory Committee. Pursuant to the TPA Emergency Order 2021-01, the Palm Beach TPA is conducting this meeting virtually using the Zoom webinar platform. The TPA selected this platform because it does not require the public to purchase or download any additional software or equipment to attend this meeting. Aside from the Zoom webinar platform, that is, the participants will be using attend remotely, the public will have no discerning difference in the ability to watch the meeting from what someone physically attending the meeting. Instruction to join this virtual meeting as well as contact the information for the TPA staff members to assist you are provided on the published meeting agenda. Please note that although some members of the CAC are attending the meeting in person, committee members will be appearing at today's meeting remotely at their via webcam or telephone. Additionally, scheduled presenters and the CAC liaison will also be appearing via webcam or telephone. Staff, please call the roll so that we can establish the quorum.
So before I call the roll, I want to remind members present in person to just hit the base button to unmute yourself. And then those that are virtual, if you can remember to unmute yourself when I call the roll. So Terry Brown. Terry, you'll need to unmute on your end. I'll move forward while you're unmuting. Mark Bruner.
Here.
Wen Dang.
Here.
Greg Fagan.
I did it on my laptop. It didn't work. Okay.
Thank you, Terry. Greg Fagan. Michael Fitzpat. Oh, I have Greg joined as an attendee, so I will promote him to a panelist and mark him as present. Michael Fitzpatrick.
Here.
Glenn Harvey.
Here.
Jason Mankoff. And I do have a 561 number calling in, Madam Chair. I do want to allow them to talk in case it is Jason. Jason, if I do have a 561-400 number, if you can unmute on your end.
Yeah, this is Jason. I'm here. I didn't know how to unmute, so you just said to unmute. But yeah.
Okay, perfect. So if you can mute it on your cell phone, and I'll leave you unmuted on Zoom. So Jason Mankoff is present. Albert Richwagen.
Here.
Ryan Rossi.
Here.
Paula Ryan.
Here.
Myra Newman.
Here.
Richard Vasilotti.
Here.
We have a quorum, Madam Chair.
Great. Are there any modifications to the agenda?
No, Madam Chair.
Are there any changes to the minutes? If not, we can have a motion to adopt the minutes as presented.
Move approval of the most recent minutes.
I'll second. Terry Brown.
Thank you. So I have a motion by Myron and a second by Terry.
Okay. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Nay. Okay. Motion carried. I've summarized our public comments procedure for this virtual meeting. Written comments may be submitted online at the website provided in the agenda. Verbal comments may be made by a virtual attendee using the raise hand feature in the Zoom platform. And lastly, verbal or written comment may be provided by an in-person attendee submitting a comment card available to the welcome table. Are there any general comments have been received at this time?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay, we're moving to item E. If any committee members have a comment for the committee, please utilize the raise hand function in the Zoom platform to ask to be recognized. And remember to unmute your microphone once you're recognized. Right now, I'd like to invite Jason to review the liaison.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, you went by too fast. I do have Myron with his hand raised.
Oh, I apologize, Myron.
That's okay. I just, my comment it deals with the membership of the committee. We have 12 members, 21 are authorized. And I'm wondering if the staff can tell us what the TPA board chair and TPA executive office are doing to encourage the other the members of the TPA board who have not appointed people or nominated people to the CAC to get their acting gear. We should have 21 members and we only have 12.
I'm Iron, this is Jason. So we've been tracking this item since you brought it up. We did the survey, we've reached out to all of the board members, we've written letters to them. Nick does one-on-ones with them before the prior to the board meetings and probably reminds them then. And then in his type of liaison report to the board, he reminds them again. And we've been consistently getting invitations or at least resumes from different people, from different board members to be invited to join the CAC. So we have another member that'll be joining, I think, next month. So I think you'll see regularly members start to three. Okay. So yeah, we're getting three new members as of your request to do the survey. It kind of prompted us to encourage everyone and reach out again and reignite this issue. And it's paying off and we're getting new members.
Good. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. So are there any other members that have comments at this time? Okay. So seeing none, we can move to the next item. I invite Jason to review the
liaison. Madam Chair, I'm sorry again. Richard Vazalotti raised his hand right after you moved on.
I truly apologize. I do not see the raise hand function. So please, Richard.
I apologize. Must be my connection. As you guys know, I'm new here. This is my third meeting. I don't know when the correct time to ask about this is, but I know last meeting we talked about this zero vision that the TPA has adopted from the state. I would just like to be briefed, you know, a little bit about it and more thoroughly, what's it about? That's my question whenever we get to that, please. Thank you.
Sure. And I think staff can answer your question. I have a lot of knowledge on Vision Zero. It is a policy that's, started in Europe and really caught up like a wildfire in the States to target a goal where we achieve zero of fatalities and serious injury within our roadway network. Florida itself is the 14th, especially the South Florida area in the Palm Beach, Broward, and Miami metropolitan is 14th on the most dangerous area for all pedestrian. This is a report that came out of Smart Growth America. They do this assessment on every year. I think the Orlando metropolitan area is the number one most dangerous area for pedestrian. And what that does, it's the TPA has different pillars, but it's the basis of it is it targets three platforms. It's the three E's or the five E's. Ultimately, it's the way that we engineering our streets, and then we enforce it, and then ultimately it's education. So engineering, education, enforcement, that really helps accomplish these goals of having zero fatalities within our roadway network. I do believe if you join, look at the TPA's website, there is quite a bit of resources that's on there already. Other cities have a lot of success. If you go to New York DOT, they've done a lot of work where they have really had a lot of success reducing like 30% within the first like 3 to 5 years that they started their program. San Francisco, LA DOT, it's really the right way of approaching as far as we're talking about safety and how funding is being safe. Being funded for our streets also. The city of West Palm Beach, that is where my previous employment was at. When they started Vision Zero in 2018, within the first year, the target corridor has gone down by 22%, I believe. That's my brief knowledge that I have of Vision Zero itself, but I'm sure staff can provide additional information for you.
If I may add to that, as this committee discussed a couple of years ago, in establishing priorities among local projects, but we recommended that the implications of local projects for progress toward Vision Zero be included as one of the measurement characteristics for establishing priorities. So it has an effect on funding. or potentially has an effect on funding.
Yes. Are there anyone else that would like to make a comment at this time? No raise hands?
Nope. I was hesitating just to be sure.
Yeah. Now we can move to item F in our agenda, which is, again, for the third time, I invite Jason for the liaison report.
Thank you, Wen. So I'll go over the liaison report that was also included in your packet and up on the slide as a PowerPoint. First one is a quick staff update as we expand our staff. We're excited to welcome Robin Probramski as the TPA Executive Secretary and Alora Farr as our TPA Procurement and Grants Coordinator. We have welcomed them aboard and we look forward to their contributions to the TPA's mission and vision. Next, as you know, is
I can hardly hear you, Jason.
March is Florida Bicycle Month. So I think we have this exclusively being one of the southernmost state. And so the TPA is encouraging local governments and partner agencies to host events to promote bicycling and bicycling safety. And so you can go to walkbikepalmbeach.org to find out more about our events. And we're holding a few different webinars. We're doing a bike ride this month as well that will you'll hear more about. And the next item here is the Strategic Highway Safety Program. FDOT is requesting public comments for their Strategic Highway Safety Plan. This draft plan is posted and available for public comments through March 10th, 2021. So to provide comments, go to fdot.gov/safety to provide comments for the Strategic Highway Safety Plan for Florida DOT. Next, our TPA Governing Board meeting will be held on March 18th at 9 a.m., both in person and virtually, so you can participate in either forum. You can find more details at palmbeachtpa.org/board. The Complete Streets Act of 2021, we have Senator Markey and Congressman Steve Cohen have reintroduced the Complete Streets Act of 2029. It's a bill that promotes safer and more accessible street designs across the United States. And so there's activity on the federal level to promote complete streets. Next, our Infrastructure for Rebuilding America INFRA grants. There's a 2021 INFRA discretionary grant program funds transportation projects of national and regional significance with a focus on climate change and environmental justice. And deadlines to apply are March 19th, which is fast approaching. And so the website to get more information is transportation.gov/buildamerica/financing. Next, the AARP Community Grant. Community Challenge Grants. This is the AARP Community Challenge Grant that provides small grants for quick action projects that can help communities become more livable for people of all ages. And there's a deadline to apply for these funding April 14th, 2021. And for more information, you can find about the grant, you can find that at aarp.org/community challenge. And next, we've covered this a couple of times, the high visibility enforcement funding. FDOT continues to offer local enforcement agencies funding contracts for high visibility enforcement to improve pedestrian and bicycle safety. And so applications are accepted on a rolling basis. And the website is provided here. So if you feel like maybe your constituents in your municipality could benefit from this, please pass it on and share it. And lastly is our TPA funding for our programs, for the two funding programs, the Local Initiatives and the Transportation Alternatives Grant Program, which Myron had mentioned about the Vision Zero, is incorporated into the scoring of these programs. And we have just closed the application process on February 26th, last Friday, and received all of our applications. The text here shows you how many applications have been received and the amount of money being requested. And following that, on the next slide, you'll see basically a list of all of the projects for both of the all three programs. We also have the State Road Modifications Program, which is listed at the bottom of the screen. The first one is the Local Initiatives Program. That's the program that I manage, and you'll see that there's an asterisk on the first five projects. Those projects are the unfunded prioritized projects that are carried over from last year that were not funded, but will be prioritized for funding this year, followed by the five projects that were applied for this year. I won't read over all of the projects. They're listed here. If you have any questions on them, please follow up with me. And there's the Transportation Alternatives Program. There was also five projects applied for the Transportation Alternatives Program. So 10 collectively, and you can see the total amounts. The total requested for local initiatives was upwards of 30 million and approximately almost 4.5 million for transportation alternatives. And that concludes my update for the liaison report.
All right, thank you so much. Are there any public comments on this item at this time?
No, Madam Chair.
So are there any committee members that would like to make a comment on this report?
I don't have any hands raised.
So I think that's great. Thank you so much, especially seeing all the transportation alternative projects that came in. So at this time, I'm going to move to the action item number two. I'd like to invite Andrew, to the TPA Deputy Director of Program Development, to present on this item.
Good afternoon, everyone. So I'll be presenting the 2021 legislative priorities for you all. And this is an action item today. And really what we're hoping to achieve from this is just your thoughts on these priorities we have. And we want this to be an open discussion, really, so we can get your feedback. First, to go through our mission and vision, to collaboratively plan, prioritize, and fund transportation with the vision of a safe, efficient, connected, and multimodal transportation system. So you'll see these legislative priorities categorized based on our vision of a safe, efficient, and connected multimodal transportation system. And really what we would like done with this is if these are, the importance of these legislative priorities are really to define what truly matters for us. And if it's something that really does matter, we need to adopt those formally and then push for those, not only locally in one direction, but also how we may influence and push these policies at the state and federal level. So why do this? First, to grow local consensus on future mobility vision for the Palm Beach County and then also our region, to balance products and land development patterns. So having a balance of not only how we're going to be funding transportation in the future, but what kind of land development patterns do we want to have and the policies around those to go towards that mobility vision. And then consider timely pursuit of additional revenue sources to accomplish that vision. And then next is bringing it to a higher level of advancing these priorities into the region's priorities into the state legislature to impact policy. And then also to impact policy at the federal level. So the past federal transportation reauthorization bill, which is before it was the Fixing America's Surface Transportation Act, that one was extended for a year. It expires September 30th, 2021. And so you all have may have heard of us discussing this previously, and you might have heard in the news. That's something that's been the language being written and going to be enacted, hopefully coming up soon here in this federal legislation cycle. So hopefully we'll see a new authorization soon, but having the ability to sort of have a say in that and discussion and how that's formed is the importance of these legislative priorities. So what prior TPA actions is this legislative priorities based off of? So what you'll see in here, obviously all together is new in this format, but they really all originated from other plans and other resolutions that have been either adopted or supported by the TPA or by the region. First, we have our updated 2045 long-range transportation plan that the TPA adopted that sets goals, objectives, and targets. It also included a high-capacity transit network where we want to invest in the future for high-capacity transit. We have the Vision Zero Action Plan, which had created a Vision Zero target of zero fatalities and serious injuries. And in those was also actions related to policy recommendations for legislative, educational, and road design actions. Then there's the Southeast Florida 2045 Regional Transportation Plan, which is the partnership between Palm Beach County, Broward, and Miami-Dade towards a regional vision between the three MPOs. So that creates that regional mobility vision. It also has a list of regional policies that were supported by the TPA Governing Board. And the last one I wanted to focus on the top right of the screen there is we as a TPA are a metropolitan planning organization. And the other ones in our state, those other MPOs, come together in a group called the MPO Advisory Council. And so they also set legislative priorities. And many of those mirror what you see in our other documents as well. So sustainable revenue into the future, flexible funding, and then technology and innovation. So what you'll see in these coming slides are all more of a culmination of some of the things in these documents. So I'll go through them based on our goals. So the first one being safe. Many of our safe legislative priorities originated from our Vision Zero Action Plan. The first one is to change state or federal law related to expanding distracted driving laws, obeying crossing guards, automated speed enforcement, and requiring helmets for bicyclists, and including safety tech on new vehicles. Next is enhanced education. So requiring annual safe walk bike curriculum, requiring driver's ed in our high schools, and then requirement of passing tests of pedestrian, bicycle, and motorcycle laws to obtain or renew driver's license. And the last one for safe is related more towards design and how we build roadways. So revised roadway design standards to be more based on context classification, so the context of the surrounding environment in that area, to use target speed and not existing speed, meaning what based on that context classification, what should be the actual speed out there, not based on historic existing speeds in that corridor, but what the community generally wants as priority. And lastly, allow installation of safe pedestrian crossing treatments at mid-block and unsignalized locations. So providing more flexibility in those design standards to allow those types of treatments. Next is efficient. So to provide funding to advance autonomous, connected, and electric vehicles and infrastructure. So becoming more efficient in not only mobility, but how much we can stretch our current capacity of our roadways and other transportation infrastructure through technology, and also providing more environmental sustainable and efficiency as well. And number five, allow MPOs within large urbanized areas to directly receive federal transportation funds or to swap federal and state funds to maximize efficient delivery of transportation products on local facilities. So that's a mouthful and that's a lot to digest there. But what really this number five is meaning is trying to streamline the process for locals to build transportation products with federal funds. So, and there's two mechanisms that we're showing on this. The first being for MPOs to directly receive federal funds. So the ones that we prioritize local initiatives and transportation alternatives, for the MPOs themselves to administer those, which would hopefully streamline the administration of those for locals. And then the second one is many of these states are doing this, but swapping federal and state funds, which means that some of these states out there are swapping their federal funds with the state. So in this case, it'd be FDOT for state funds. And what that does is it allows the TPA and the projects that we prioritize with locals, those locals don't have to go through the federal process anymore. And all those additional restrictions that might come with having federal funds. So it'd be a streamlined process using state funds instead.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I do have a question from Paula Ryan. I don't know if you want to take questions at the end or if she can ask it quickly.
If it's related to this item, then I think maybe we should have her ask this question now.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to understand the funding that we're talking about. Can these dollars be looked at being used any differently in terms of new projects versus rehabilitation of projects, like so many of the other resources?
Are you talking about number five there?
Yeah.
No, this wouldn't. So that's a very good question. The way the funds being prioritized, that wouldn't change. So when we talk about these funds, federal funds, the ones that are coming directly to the MPOs right now, for an MPO our size, are those surface transportation block grant funds. And that's $20 million that funds the local initiatives program that Jason oversees. And transportation alternatives is another $3 million that Alyssa oversees. So that's the direct prioritization of federal funds. That really doesn't change. We'll have the exact same prioritization process. What would change is when the cities submit those products to us, they're obviously going to be getting federal funds. So FDOT is the one to help them through delivery of that those projects. And they must follow all the federal requirements of that. And FDOT administers that process with them. They oversee that process. And from my understanding of it is the state sort of has additional criteria that they require the locals to also do in that process. And so potentially if an MPO were to do it, potentially could streamline that process a little bit more than maybe what EFTA could do. That's the sort of the high level of that. Whether that's in the end, the true direction, you know, I think this is more of a legislative priority that sort of like just presents it as an opportunity there to explore more rather than that actually be set in stone. Because that is, it could, you know, that is a big step for us as an MPO to have to oversee the federal, you know, process of that. So, but no, there is no different prioritization of that.
Hey, Andrew, this is one. When you were talking about number five and I understand how to administer a federally funded project through the FDOT, it's quite complicated with a lot of requirements, as we call it. But ultimately, when you, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you swap out federal funds on state funds, it's only applying on state routes. It wouldn't apply to local priorities, would it?
Yes, that's a good point. And so what our chair is referencing is state funds, mostly state gas taxes, must be spent on state roadways. So in order to enact the second portion of number five there, that would have to be a change to the legislation. So you would have to change legislation to allow state funds to be spent off system, off the state roadway system.
Okay, thank you so much.
Madam Chair, I also have Myron with his hand raised.
Yeah, I have a question too. I'm really uncertain about what this means, allow MPOs within large urban areas to directly receive or to receive federal funds directly. I don't like the split infinitives, if I can avoid it. This would require a change in federal law, is that right? Is that what you're talking about here?
Because
federal funds go to the states and then the states distribute it to the MPOs, right?
Myron, I can't speak confidently on that. Whether there's other places throughout the country that are directly receiving those federal funds, like other MPOs that are directly receiving those federal funds, or if they're going through the state and then the MPO.
From my understanding and experience in Washington, when transportation authorizations are made, There are formulas that go by state. If the formulas are then to be renegotiated to include local NPOs, I cannot imagine the political problems that would raise, because as you know, the political world is defined as when presented with a trough, oink. And I have a great deal of trouble with the first part of this expression. I understand, and I know that there are occasions where a project may be federally funded, and for one reason or another, the state would rather fund it with state funds and use the federal funds for something else. That's perfectly reasonable. But I just don't think this business, I would have a hard time recommending allowing NPOs to receive federal funds directly from the federal government because of the political problems associated with that.
Andrew, if I may interrupt this, and again, if I may put a different perspective on number five, again, so the intention is that the MPOs, TPAs, would directly receive the funds and directly administer the projects with the local governments? Or is it still the same process where, because again, you know, these grant programs, local initiatives, as we see, all these applications that come in, whether it's FTA or where if it's FHWA, these kind of fundings that's coming from, ultimately it's a reimbursement program. So city governments, let's say the city of Boca, apply for a project and it gets prioritized. Ultimately, the city has to budget within their own budget, $3-5 million, whatever that may be, and the match, and then go through all the requirements for pre-design, you know, if there's land acquisition, all that, meet all those requirements of NEPA, the Uniform Act, all that, even during construction is quite a bit of work as far as, you know, how these projects are being administered before local governments can receive reimbursement. You know, it took years for city government to receive reimbursement. And I guess, like, to clarify what the intention of number five is, the intent to directly administer funds to the local government, or it's only to swap funds and make it less of a process when the these programs are going through development.
Yes. So to clarify, it's not to give it directly to the cities. No, it'd still be administered, it'd be administered by the MPOs. So it wouldn't be direct to the cities. We'd still need to carry out a federal required process on that, and it would just be an MPO overseeing that process with you, instead of it being an FDOT product manager that oversees it. So if you're a city engineer, you're dealing with somebody on the FDOT staff to help you through that process. This instead would be done through somebody at the MPO.
Yeah.
And the state's the one who sets the criteria. Obviously there's federal criteria, but they set their own criteria on top of that when they are having you go through that process. The local agency.
And I, from my understanding of how especially when local government apply for these projects, I believe up to 5% of it is going to FDOT right now on oversight, as far as where that funding is coming from. Because my understanding is that the program pays for itself. So regardless, let's say the local government applies for $5 million, they're not necessarily getting $5 million. There's other oversights and all these fees that's being utilized as far as administering. So what I'm hearing is that those fees will go to the MPO or the TPA so that they can help go through this process.
Correct.
Yeah. No, it's from personal experience, this is a very good thing. So thank you.
Sure. I think you guys, everyone's raising very good points. You know, I think with number five, especially both those parts, the first part of that and the second part, does require more discussion and more details and a lot more process involved in that. It's, you know, right now we have it down as a line here, but there are a lot of intricacies involved in that. So I think really, you know, even when we move forward here, that's more of an exploration of those things rather than set in stone, it's going to happen. So just wanted to put that out there, that there is a lot of processes involved in this moving forward, especially number five.
It may be, Andrew, that in your attempt to be as concise as possible with number five, you've been a little bit too concise. Maybe you should break that up into a couple of other statements so that you have an opportunity to explain more of what you hope to be able to do here. Because it's really difficult to understand.
Okay. Thank you. Yep, that's a good suggestion. And I have two more slides for you. Okay, next one is connected. First is promote complementary land use patterns around existing and future high capacity transit routes. So that's getting back to the, you know, even when we're establishing these transportation networks and building those out, obviously there's the chicken and the egg there, but there's the land use development patterns surrounding those and making sure there's supportive land uses. So that's the intent of number six. And number seven is use existing maintenance funding and pursue additional funding to reconstruct roadways with enhanced pedestrian, bicycle, and transit facilities, especially near high capacity transit hubs. My last slide for you for the goal of multimodal, advance a regionally connected high capacity transit system to support anticipated growth and long-term mobility, increase flexibility within existing state transportation programs to allow the funding of high capacity transit investments and supporting infrastructure, and then seek additional funding sources at all levels to build, operate, and maintain high capacity transit. So this last one, multimodal, a lot of these are very similar policy statements that we have at the regional level for Miami-Dade and Broward as well, supporting high capacity transit and increasing flexible funding and then seeking additional funding. And I believe that's all I have for you. Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Yep.
So are there any further discussion outside of item number five that we'd like to?
I do have, Madam Chair, just for the record, there are no public comments, but I do have Paula Ryan and Myron Uman with their hands raised.
Okay, so we'll go in that order.
Oh, we don't. Oh. Okay, thank you. Number six, I think it was, promote complementary land use patterns. Do you have a strategy to start to implement that? I know that we looked at building the high-speed rail options east-west along State Road 70, and DOT came back and said, because of all the
different... A little louder, please.
Because all the different municipalities along that route and the land use was not compatible in every municipality, they rendered that to be a, you know, an ineffective solution or a not something that they could even see pursuing down the road and continue to focus on expanding.
Please speak into the mic, please.
So the TPA had said that they, not the TPA, the DOT did not want to pursue high-speed rail along areas like State Road 80. When we have looked at east-west rail for a number of years because of the different municipalities that owned the land along those routes. And each municipality had their own land use and the ability to manage such a complicated acquisition and changes to land use to allow for the acquisition was deemed to be not cost effective. So given the priority listed in number six, I think it was, mm-hmm. promote complementary land use patterns. Do you have some strategies, or do you have some areas that you would like to target? And from my perspective, that would be a very important discussion to be had around moving forward to more multimodal options.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's a very good question. So for the number six, the complementary land use patterns for existing and future high capacity transit routes. So during the creation of the long range transportation plan and then the adoption, we looked at the existing and then future development patterns along these throughout the county, along all corridors. And then based on what we were seeing in that analysis, we refined those corridors that'd be best for premium transit, for high capacity transit. And so what we're doing now is tackling those corridors at a more granular level and doing corridor studies. So the one that we've kicked off recently, which is going to have a more intense effort coming up here with the public, is Okeechobee Boulevard, going from the Wellington Mall up State Road 7, then east on Okeechobee all the way down to downtown West Palm Beach. And so in that process, we're working with the county. We've met with the county already and the planning staff regarding land uses in that, and working with the other jurisdictions. So we're tackling that in those corridors as we're doing those corridor plans as one of those strategies. And then also we had for some more of these larger tri-rail projects, you know, we do have these hubs and there's transit oriented development plans that have been done by the Treasure Coast Regional Planning Council and in collaborating with us in the cities. And so the more of those we do as well, those hopefully develop more strategies for change in development patterns and the policies around those for those tri-rail stops.
Okay, and you, I think Myron, you're next.
Yes.
Yes, I'd like to ask about item 1B on the list that's on the screen. It's from SAFE, change state and or federal law to allow automated speed enforcement and citations. I wonder if you could expand, Andy, on what the TPA has in mind here. I mean, this is a... this does require significant changes in law, I would imagine, right?
Yes.
And potentially controversial ones. I mean, so a person would not have, citations would be issued based on observation by some automated equipment rather than an officer of the law?
Correct. And you are correct, Myron. You know, I think when we implement these automated types of enforcement strategies, you know, I think everyone's familiar with the red light cameras and some of the issues that have arisen out of those nationwide, and in some places they've been able to do it appropriately, and others have seem to have some backlash from how they've implemented those. This one is related to, like you said, it would be automated tracking their speeds and then enforcing those through citations. And, you know, just from, I guess, some of the studies out there, it does seem to have a measurable effect on safety and reduction in speeds. So that's why we've supported it as staff level and a TPA, and then put in our action plan. But that is, yes, it would be a change to state policy on that.
Do you know if NCHRP or some similar organization has studied this sort of thing?
Actually, if I may interrupt, Andrew, actually New York City from 2014 to 2017 implemented their study for a reduction in a speed study as far as like automated enforcement, and they found an upward of 80% reduction within the first month of implementing this, especially around school zones. So there are some data out there I can share with Margie and the TPA, and maybe the TP can share it with other members of this committee.
Thank you.
Well, that would be interesting to see.
Yeah, I It's proven to be very effective. Other states are doing it. We're not in Florida, but it's also rightfully reflected in the number of crashes that we have. I do think that that vision really is aligns with the Vision Zero policy that's set in place from by the TPA.
Yeah, I can see this as, there's no context in this statement. It makes a lot of sense around schools, but I'm not sure it makes a lot of sense on I-95. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Make a hell of a lot of money on I-95.
Madam Chair, I have Paula Ryan with her hand raised.
Thank you, Paula Ryan.
Thank you. I believe this is a general overall objective to bring forward to the legislature our support for these kinds of issues, not developing actual policies and where these kinds of things would occur. I think that every community would tell you where a great location might be. And I think that when it comes down to implementation of anything, there's going to be a lot of public involvement, as there typically is. So for the benefit of time, I'd like to, if there's no other questions, to see if you would entertain a motion for approval of the recommended endorsement of the 2021 legislative policy positions.
All right, thank you. Is there a second?
Albert.
Okay, I'm motion by Paula and a second by Albert.
And are you ready to take a vote, Madam Chair?
I am, unless there are any other public comments or.
I don't see any other hands raised. So the motion on the floor is to recommend endorsement of the 2021 legislative positions as presented. I'm sorry, Ryan, can I have you mute on your end just because we're getting a lot of feedback? Before I call the roll, I did want to remind virtual members to please unmute. And then those that are attending in person, if you can hit the base. And Madam Chair, I do have that Rich Vasilotti does have his hand raised.
Okay. Rich?
Thank you. The portion where it says requiring all bicyclists to wear helmets, moving forward with something like that, how would that law be enforced, seeing a family with two kids with helmets on and maybe two parents with not? I mean, we're going to actually do actual law enforcement intervention with something like that, especially with everything that's going on today. I'm a little iffy on that portion there. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there anybody else with a comment? A discussion?
Okay. I don't see any other hands raised, Madam Chair.
If you don't mind, proceed with roll call.
Okay. So Terry Brown?
Yes, I approve.
Mark Bruner?
Mark Bruner's here, yes.
Thank you. Wen Deng?
Yes.
Greg Fagan? And Greg, you may need to hit *6, I believe, to unmute on your end. And while he's getting unmuted, Madam Chair, Michael Fitzpatrick?
Yes.
Glenn Harvey?
Yes.
Jason Mankoff?
Yes.
Albert Richwagon?
Yes.
Ryan Rossi?
Yes.
Paula Ryan?
Yes.
Myra Newman?
No.
Richard Vasilotti?
No.
And then again, Greg Fagan? And Greg, I believe it's either *6 or *9 that you can unmute your phone. Madam Chair, because I don't have him unmuted, I will mark him as absent from the vote because I don't have his verbal vote. So the motion passes with 2 against.
Great. So we're moving to action item number 2. I'd like to invite Andrew to present on this item.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I may have had that wrong on your end. It is Matthew Kama, our Chief Financial Officer, that will present.
Thank you so much.
Good afternoon. Now it's working. Good afternoon. We come today, we're requesting recommendation of amendment number one to our Unified Planning Work Program, our UPWP.
Please speak into the microphone, please.
Can you hear this more clearly?
Yes, go ahead.
Working on the clicker, bear with me, just there we go. Our UPWP is our business plan and our application for federal grant funds. It encapsulates—
Please speak directly into the microphone.
It encapsulates 2 years, two of our fiscal years. So July 1st of 2020 through June 30th of 2022. And it clarifies all the tasks and routine projects that we're to accomplish in that period, the who, what, when, and how much we're going to spend to accomplish those activities.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Oh, okay.
It's jumping a little bit. Can you back it up one slide? It's not responding.
We are having some technical difficulties. There. Sorry.
It's there for now. We can work with this. Okay. In fiscal year 20, we were notified by FDOT that they would no longer provide a cash match to the FTA grant program. That resulted in $160,000 in lost revenue. Further, in FY 20 and coming into fiscal year 21 of our UPWP, we recognize a reduction in available grant funds by $70,000 of anticipated funding. And the third reduction is we reduced personnel and travel expenses due to COVID-19. And at the same time, we are increasing our available budget funding for consulting in our tasks for the year. The fourth item that you see is an increase in local expenses that we're using our local funds to increase our maximize agency effectiveness, our advocacy activities, and we are reducing our public engagement to maintain that budget at the same level. This provides a more detailed view, perspective of what's happening. On the left two columns, you see our adopted UPWP budget, and on the right two columns are proposed. In red, you see the reductions, and you'll note that they are in FTA funding due to that cash match change. And we reduced and adjusted our expenditures according to the available budget as well. Separately, to view our local funds, in similar fashion, the adopted budget on the left two columns and the proposed on the right, we are reducing our public engagement by $15,000 in each year and increasing our agency effectiveness, also known as advocacy for short, during those years.
I'm sorry, excuse me. We're seeing on the screen, Ms. Andrew speaking, we're not seeing the charts that he's showing on the screen behind him.
You don't see anything shared on the screen?
I'm seeing Andrew on the screen, not the shared screen behind him, no.
Okay,
I was seeing it before when other people were presenting.
Okay, we'll reshare it. I'm so sorry about that.
There we go, perfect. You don't have to go back. I was following it on my iPad, what was emailed to me, so.
Okay.
So at this time, is this the concludes the presentation?
That does, Madam Chair.
Okay. Are there any discussion on this present at this time? Are there any public comments?
There are no public comments, Madam Chair.
Okay. Do we have any discussion internally of this board? Are there any raised hands?
I don't see any hands raised.
All right. So at this time, I'll entertain a motion for adoption.
Yes, Madam Chair, this is Paula Ryan. I'd like to make a motion to adopt or make a motion to approve recommended adoption of fiscal year 21-22 Unified Planning Work Program Amendment.
Second, by Glenn Harvey.
Okay, I have a motion by Paula Ryan and a second by Glenn. This is a roll call vote,
yes,
Margie?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay.
So if you can unmute on your end when I call your name, Terry Brown.
Yes, I approve.
Mark Bruner.
Yes.
Wen Deng.
Yes.
Greg Fagan. And Greg should be rejoining us. And Greg, you'll just need to unmute on your end. Michael Fitzpatrick.
Yes.
Glenn Harvey?
Yes.
Greg Fagan?
Yes.
Thank you. Jason Mankoff?
Yes.
Albert Richwagen?
Yes.
Ryan Rossi?
Yes.
Paula Ryan?
Yes.
Myra Newman?
Yes.
Richard Vasilotti?
Yes.
It passes unanimously, Madam Chair.
Perfect. So moving on to information item number 3, Port of Palm Beach update. I'd like to invite Carl Baker.
Okay. Who's going to be running it? Good afternoon, everybody. My name's Carl Baker. I'm the Director of Planning and Development for the Port of Palm Beach. I'd like to thank the TPA for having me here today. Understand there was a request from a member of the CAC to find out a little bit about just what was going on at the Port of Palm Beach. Well, this is probably more than you ever wanted to know, so here we go. You can see on the slide here, it says, Port of Palm Beach, 105 years of economic development. Essentially, that is our core mission, is economic development. We own the land, we own the water. It's our responsibility to put everything in place so that the tenants who work at the port and have their businesses there can prosper. Okay, slide. So you can see there's a full shot of the port. One thing that you don't see over by the cruise terminal is a cruise ship, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. Slide.
I'm sorry. I'm seeing him speaking again. I'm not seeing any of the slides.
Do I have any other members that are experiencing that?
I don't have any issues.
You may need to rejoin the meeting, Albert. I don't have anyone else that's having that issue, and I'm not.
Okay, no problem. I'll just look over his shoulder at the screen behind him.
Okay, I'm sorry about that.
Wait a minute. Does that help? Okay, some of the numbers for the port. First slide. You can see the last year we moved almost 280,000 TEUs. That's a 20-foot container. That's the industry standard on how you measure how many boxes you've moved each year. That makes us the fourth busiest container port in all of Florida. And you've got 14 ports in Florida. So you've got Jacksonville, Miami, and Everglades are first, second, and third for containers, and then ourselves. And then you've got all those other ports. You've got Canaveral, you've got Manatee, you've got Port St. Joe, Panama City, the Port of Tampa. We do, and Canaveral, we do more containers than all of those other guys put together. That makes us the 18th busiest container port in the entire United States. And that we are also one of only 16 net export ports in the country. You know how the balance of trade payments in this country is really upside down. Well, it's not our fault. Approximately 80% of everything that goes out of approximately 80% of everything that moves at the port is an export. Very little comes in here. And our total value of everything we moved last year was approaching $23 billion. And we do this all in 165 acres. As a reference, Port of Miami, which is an island, is about 900 acres. Port Everglades is 1,750. The Port of Tampa is 5,000 acres. Yet, so we're doing quite a bit in a very, very small spot. A little bit on our governance. We are a special taxing district, a subdivision of the state of Florida. We've been here since 1915, which is well before most other things in Palm Beach County. Slide. We're governed by a board of five elected commissioners. These are port commissioners. We're not part of the county. We're not part of Riviera Beach or West Palm Beach. We are our own entity. The commissioners are elected from inside the port district, which runs from the ocean out to Lake Okeechobee and from Southern Boulevard in the south up to Donald Ross Road in the north. Our commissioners serve four-year terms. And even though we're a special taxing district, the port has not used its authority to tax in the past 43 years. We make our income off of user fees. Every time Tropical Shipping swings a container across the dock, we make some money. Every time Florida Sugar pours a pound of sugar into a barge going north, we make a little money. Little here, little there, it all adds up. And it's not just containers that we do either. Last year, you can see pushing 700,000 tons of sugar out of the port. This is about 40% of what's grown in the Glades. This sugar is brought into the port in trucks, 20 tons at a time, stored in this warehouse, and then it is loaded into sugar barges. Right now, the main market for these barges is the Domino facility up in Yonkers, New York, which is where it goes. And you can see we can send up 45 sugar barges, which is how many we sent last year. Or you can use approximately 10,000 rail cars, or we can put approximately 39,000 trucks on I-95, which means that 39,000 trucks are going to have to come back down I-95 to get more sugar. So you can see that barges are a very efficient way to move lots of cargo very cheaply. A lot of other things, liquid asphalt. This is where most of the roads come from around here. We bring in the asphalt and it's liquid. And at this point, it's just kind of a black tarry goo. The construction companies come in, pick it up, put up their, add in their rocks and their polymer and their subbase and their secret sauce and go out and lay it down on the roads. It's 350 degrees inside those tanks just to keep everything liquid. Another thing we do is yacht transport. There is a disgustingly large amount of this going on. There's kind of a three-way circuit between Northern Europe, the Mediterranean, and South Florida, predominantly our port, where these yachts move depending on if there's a yacht show, if they're trying to sell a yacht, what the season is, because as expensive as this is to move a boat like that, it's still cheaper than filling it up full of diesel fuel and driving it across the Atlantic, and a lot safer. Ship-to-rail heavy lift. Those two large yellow cranes you see in the background are attached to a ship, and they are unloading a 450-ton transformer for Florida Power and Light, which is going into a deep well rail car that's set up to carry those kind of loads. And it's going out to an FPNL facility somewhere in South Florida. we're the only port in Jackson, excuse me, we're the only port in Florida other than Jacksonville that can do this kind of cargo movement. Cruise ships. I'm sure you probably know the last year has been really bad for cruise ships. We used to have two cruise ships, but let me show you what the cruise ship market has turned into. You can see we were doing pretty good, and then COVID came along, and that's it. One of our cruise ships is tied to a palm tree somewhere in the Bahamas, trying to wait this out. The other cruise ship that we had, the Grand Celebration, is sitting on a beach on the northwest coast of India while it is cut up into small pieces for scrap. There's a lot of that going on right now. Carnival Shipping is scrapping 17 cruise ships as we speak. A lot of the other ports that are heavy into the cruise market have just been devastated. Port Canaveral, which is predominantly a cruise ship port, their income is down something like 60%. They're unable to make their bond payments. They've laid off 50 or 60 staff. It's ugly. Port of Miami, same thing. They're down about 45% on the cruise ship side, and they're not making enough to cover their monthly payments down there either. So it's bad pretty much everywhere. We're fortunate. We're diversified enough that this is a hit, but it's only about a 10% total hit to the budget. Again, obviously the cruise business went away. The container count is down about 8 or 9%. Because all of those containers are going to the Caribbean, but there's no cruise ships and no passengers and no people down there to take the goods that come in those containers. So that business has dried up. However, sugar exports have gone way up. Liquid asphalt has gone way up. Steel reinforcing rods have gone way up. So little here, little there. All in all, we made money last year, and there's not too many ports can say that anywhere in the United States. Slide. The main part of the program here is our, back in November, the Port of Palm Beach was awarded a port information, a PIDP grant, Port Infrastructure Development Program grant. This just for 13 million and change. This did not just fall out of the sky for us. We spent over a year working on getting the grant. We had applied for a CRISI grant and didn't make it. We then rewrote that to apply for an INFRA grant, and that didn't happen. And then we turned around and we rewrote the rewrite and went after the PIDP grant, and we were successful this time. We were the only port in Florida that got a PIDP grant this time from the Department of Transportation, and we were one of only 18 grant awards in the entire country for this. So we're rather proud of ourselves for that one. Not only do we have that money, but we've got another $4 million in change that been awarded for Florida Department of Transportation that is going to go straight into the rail program. We already physically have that money. Now we have to match both of these grants at 50-50, but that gives us a total of $34,847,000 to do something with. And even in this day's economy, that's a lot of money, and we can do a lot with that. Rail's always been real important here at the Port of Palm Beach. You can see this is our very first warehouse being built in 1929. And down there in the right corner underneath the building, you can see a little narrow gauge rail track that's got some lumber on it. That was laid over the sand to bring it in from the main set of railroad tracks on the other side of US 1. So again, rail, we started with rail a long time ago. We went from there to this in 1948. You can see all the rail cars that are out on the dock. The ship, the right-hand ship, is one of the Florida Havana Railroad ferries that ran down to Cuba. We had four to five of these ships leaving out of the port, and they carried everything from Port of Palm Beach down into Havana. And if you wonder why us, Well, in 1948, there was no Port of Miami. There was no port of Port Everglades. If you wanted to go to Cuba, it was either us or Tampa. And Tampa wasn't very big then. So we were, by the late 50s, I'm sorry, here's one more. It's a little dark, but you can see they're using a steam locomotive to push railroad cars into one of these car ferries. They could, and if you think that was inefficient, you would be wrong. They could push 18 rail cars into a ship and tie them down in an hour and a half. In 3 hours, they could completely strip a ship and reload it ready for sailing again. And here's one of the ships leaving. We sent a ship to Havana every other day. And by 1958, we were the biggest trading partner with Cuba of any port in the entire world. Here's an aerial of the port. You can see inside the yellow lines, that's the actual port. There's our 165 acres. And we're adjacent to the Florida East Coast Railroad. I mean, immediately adjacent, as in the other side of the fence adjacent. And while FEC is predominantly double track through here and single tracked in places in Palm Beach County, it's triple tracked where it runs alongside the port. We're working on a couple of phases. This where it says inside the green box where it says completed, that's the first rail project we did about a year and a half ago. That was $1.2 million. And you can see the new track. It's nice and the rock is nice and shiny. We call that the Big Curve project. Again, that was $1.2 million. That's the main entrance into the port. And you can see right over on the left side of the picture, there's the triple track from Florida East Coast Railroad. So that is, as I said, as adjacent as you can possibly get. Now that we've got that done, we're going to move to the east and do our next set of, which is we're calling phase two in that drawing. And phase two is a lot of our storage track. And you can see that running out towards the top of the screen. And we're going to rebuild all of that track. And that is under engineering right now. They're working out. They've got to redo some curves and get everything to align up with our next project. But that's currently in the design phase right now. Slide. The main thing that this new PIDP project is going to do is it's going to consolidate and really increase the amount of rail cars we can put on the port and we can store on the port. You can see those little short lines. We can, right now, the way the switches are set up, and some of those switches and some of that rail has been there since, you know, they had rail cars going to Cuba run down them. It's really inefficient. You can only put strings of 6 to 8 rail cars at a time on them. So when you're having to switch back and forth, there's a lot of lost time just moving cars around. So we're going to rip out all of those 4 tracks to the east. All of that's going to get ripped out. We're going to repave everything in 6,000 PSI concrete. And then we're going to push all the tracks to the north. Now, the reason we can get away with moving everything north like that is, and now instead of using reach stackers to unload the rail cars and then have the straddle carriers pick them up, we're going to use straddle carriers running up and down the rail cars. And the way that's going to work is that the straddle carrier will come into the east end of the tracks, get lined up, stopped. The driver up there in the cab will push a button and it will turn into RoboStrad. The strad will drive itself down the straddling the rail cars, get to the box it needs to pick up, pick that box up and take itself to the west end of the tracks under Skypass and make a U-turn and then go down to the ships. So that'll get a lot of efficiency and we can start running much longer strings of cars that way. Then the last big part of that project is we're going to relocate the tropical interchange. The interchange is where all of the 18-wheelers with containers that are being shipped out come into tropical shipping. And it's that building up there in purple. And it kind of looks like that. And that's where they weigh the containers and the computer assigns them to a location in the stacks. And all of that is about a half a step this side of complete artificial intelligence. It's very little human involvement in doing that. So we're going to take that box and move it around the corner just to to help realign and speed everything up with. And the end result of all of that is going to be, right now we move about 43,000 TEUs a year by rail, which is 15% of our throughput, which makes us the highest intermodal freight rail user of any port in Florida. And because we're going to do all of this stuff, we can. Oh, I'm sorry. And the way things are set up right now, the most number of containers we can shove through the port on rail is about 44,000 a year. That's our absolute theoretical maximum. And this port operates 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And we only close down for hurricanes. But with the new system, we're going to be able to shove about 95,000 TEUs through rail every year, which, like I said, is 116% increase in capacity. So it's quite an improvement. Last slide. Our theoretical maximum for containers moved through the port right now is 500,000. There's just absolutely no way in the world you can move more containers than that. But if without doing this rail project, to get to that 500,000, we would have to add another 29,000 truck trips a year on the local road system. And absolutely nobody here wants that. And we understand that. Rail was our past and rail is our future. And we're going into rail in a very big way. Thank you. Questions?
Yes, I have a question.
Please.
I was just curious as to the asphalt that you talked about. You import that in?
Yes.
Or is it? Yeah. So it comes from where?
Venezuela, Colombia.
Yeah. I knew it was coming from Venezuela in the past. I didn't know if that's changed.
Yeah, that's where we're getting it now. Sometimes. And
then who owns the asphalt? You don't own it. A company owns it, markets it out.
There's a company there, the tanks. Those silver tanks are owned by a company called South Florida Materials.
Okay.
They are the owners of the asphalt.
Okay, you did all right answering that correctly. I'm just funning with you. Then the other question I have is how much revenue from the sugar transport goes to the port? I mean, how much of the revenue that you receive from them is a percentage of your revenue that comes in? How big are they?
I'll get back to you on that.
Okay.
I can't answer that one off the top of my head. What the percentage of revenue is, because there's a couple of different levels of revenue. We get revenue every time that barge and tug comes into the port and they throw a line over to dock, and they're normally there for, two business days. So we get money off of that. We get money off of every pound of sugar. I think it's 1.9 cents a pound that they blow into the barge. So we get money off of that. And then we own the land that their terminal sits on. They built Florida Sugar Molasses Exchange built that terminal back in 1978. It's their building, but it's on our land. So we're getting the land lease, we're getting the cargo throughput, and then we're getting the dockage fee for the tug and barge.
So you're kind of landlocked there. You can't expand at all.
Really. Oh, no, that's a big problem. Obviously, we can't go north right now because you've got Riviera Beach and there's an interlocal agreement that says we can't. We can't go west because we've got the FEC railroad tracks literally on the other side of our fence. and we can't go south because there's a brand new $1.4 billion Florida Power and Light power plant in the way.
Aren't some of the marinas to the north privately all privately owned?
Yes, they're all privately owned.
Okay, thank you.
I have questions.
I believe is that Myron or Terry? Yes.
Myron, no, new voice.
No, I finished.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I do have that Myron has his hand raised, and it seems that Michael Fitzpatrick also has questions.
Okay, so we'll go to Myron and then Michael.
Thank you. The implication of rail is very, obviously you need rail desperately. I'm wondering about, a few years ago, we discussed the concept of the so-called inland port, intermodal transfer facility in the Everglades.
Yes.
And one of the issues with that was rail transit to there, between the port and there. Can you briefly tell us what the status of the inland port is and what the opportunities and problems you see?
The status is it's in a very deep coma, and it's not likely to come out anytime soon. There's a lot of people agree that the concept of an inland port is correct and proper. There's a number of other inland ports, inland logistics facilities in this country and overseas, and they work. The problem here is nobody particularly wants to be the guinea pig and wants to put up the money to get it going. There's a lot of, I was involved, I wrote the very first inland port presentation for the port probably 18 years ago. So I've been at this a while. There's been a lot of studies done. Everybody agrees that somewhere around the bottom of Lake Okeechobee or just to the east of that is a good place to put it because the available affordable land south of there, once you get into Dade and Broward counties or South Palm Beach County, just doesn't exist. It's like, find me 1,000 acres. You just can't do it. It doesn't exist. So the idea is move it a little north. Well, you've got to get your cargo there. The Florida Department of Transportation has had a number of studies done and you know, about how do we do this? Well, one, you can get rail up US 27. And that study's been done 3 or 4 times. Every time the study's done, everybody says, yes, this is a great idea. And nobody wants to cough up a billion, yeah, with a B, dollars on getting that rail laid down on US 27. And this is where the state already owns the right of way. So it's just basically construction costs. There's no land acquisition cost and true land acquisition cost involved. It's just not going to work. You know, at some point, people will realize, okay, we've filled in everything else. The Port of Miami found some land that they could have just west of the airport that's got some rail connection. So they're, building that out heavily. Port Everglades' position has been, we've got land. Why would we want to get involved in this? And Port of Palm Beach is, okay, it's a good idea, but we don't have the money to do anything.
So exports through the port from the Everglades agricultural area will continue to be trucked there.
Correct. The port, right? Yeah, correct.
There's no rail connection.
I'm sorry, sir?
No. Rail is not in the foreseeable future.
It is. We can get to the Glades today on rail, but you've got to go to Fort Pierce and make a left. And it's just not economically feasible right now. The rule of thumb is rail under about 300, any rail trip under about 300 miles just does not make any economic sense. If you're going to be running sugar from the Glades, truck is the way to do it right now. There's just financially and logistically, rail just doesn't pay for itself for such a short run.
Thank you.
I have a couple of questions. First of all, the sugar barges, what are the sizes of those and how do they go north? What pushes them up there?
The barges are about 380 feet. They max out at about 4,000 tons. And what you don't see in the picture is about a 110-foot tugboat. And they don't push them, they pull them.
Well, yeah. How many do they pull at a time? One per?
One. Yeah, one barge, one tug.
Of course, the inland waterway was supposed to be for barge traffic. That's never coming back, right?
Right, and that was never for, right. And that was for, the last time that was really talked about big was back in the 50s, and, you know, so they could run their cucumbers in from Belglade to town, and obviously, you know, that was before the road network is like it is. So that you know, the cross Florida barge canal is, you know, great if you've got a small boat and you want to take it to Tampa, but I mean, you're not going to be carrying commercial traffic down it,
right?
And certainly not ocean going barges. I mean, those sugar barges, when they go out of here, are drafting 31-32 feet.
When I was a kid, parents used to take me to the International House of Pancakes at some place called the International Bazaar. I'm trying to figure out where that was. Was that on port land?
Yes. Can you go back to the original aerial picture? Yeah. Stand by, sir.
I sort of know where it was. I wasn't sure who owned it.
Yeah. You know, okay. It's one more. Go forward one more to the, okay. If you notice, if you look at the yellow box, it's got the port in it. In the big box west of the Sky Pass Bridge, there's a large white roof, white building.
Mm-hmm.
That is the location of the old International Trade Bazaar. It went further east than that. That's probably the western two-thirds of it. Then there's the parking lot in front. And then the right off the northwest corner up against the bridge is where the observation tower used to be.
Right, so right.
The Port of Palm Beach bought the land that the World Trade Bazaar sat on in 1994. And the intent was, is we were going to put that warehouse there. It took a long time for it to happen, but the port bought the land and the building in 94.
Okay. I'm a past chair of the local group of the Sierra Club. And I remember, like, I don't know, at least 10 years ago, there was a lot of talk about turning radiuses and having to dredge and seagrass and stuff. How did that all shake out?
It's dead. We got a WERDA bill passed through Congress that allowed us to do the project, but there was, as you well know, there was a lot of community blowback from that. Some of it was justified. Some of it we feel, you know, wasn't. There was a phenomenal amount of misinformation floating around because of that. But for the foreseeable future, it's a non-issue. It's not going to happen. And the I believe in about a year and a half, our WERDA grant, or the authorization, not the, there's no grant, we never got any money. The authorization expires in about a year and a half.
Thank you for your report. It was very informative.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I have Richard Vazalotti with his hand raised.
Sure, Richard.
Thank you. Great presentation, Mr. Baker. Obviously, you have the attention of a lot of the panelists here. A quick question. You mentioned 80% exports from the port, I believe you said.
Yes.
If you broke that number down, how much of that remains exported in the United States compared to overseas out of the country? Thank you.
No, when I said 80% export, that's 80% of the cargo that moves through the port is going out of the inlet and going down to either Canada or the Caribbean or to Europe. And there's only 20% of the total volume is coming into the port.
Okay. But besides that, places like to New York, do you export to, that remains the United States, or is that 80% out of the country?
That's the sugar is, as far as customs goes, sugar is neither fish nor fowl. That is considered, if back on this line, it says import, export, and domestic. The sugar is domestic cargo. So even though it's going out the inlet and making a left, it's not being exported out of the country, but it is going to New York. That's the only domestic cargo we have. Everything else, but we're considering that part of the 80% because it's not coming in. It is going out. It's just not going foreign. So we've got a lot of trade back and forth with Canada. And then, of course, from the Bahamas all the way down to Grenada and now Suriname, we've got the scrap steel is being exported out to Turkey. So that's the major export destinations. For imports, it's going to be the liquid asphalt. It's going to be the rebar, various, one-off specialty projects. That 450-ton transformer came out of Spain.
Thank you again. Great presentation.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Do we have, okay, so right now we're going to move on to item 3B. It's an FDOT update on sea level rise. So at this time, I'd like to invite Lois Bush to present on this item.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. I'm Lois Bush with District 4, and I'm here to share information with you on resilience and transportation. Next slide, please. Drawing on our experiences in Southeast Florida, this presentation will cover what FDOT and partners have been doing to increase transportation system resiliency, what is known about vulnerability of transportation infrastructure in Southeast Florida, how data, tools, and approaches relating to resilience are evolving, how resilience is being incorporated into long-range planning for the transportation system, and how studies are evolving. Next slide, please. What are we doing? Next slide, please. This graphic shows the typical progression for transportation projects. Long-range transportation plans address transportation at a system level and are a key source for projects that go through the project development process. Project development and environment, PD&E, is the planning phase for a project. The PD&E phase is followed by design, right-of-way acquisition as needed, and construction. Operations and maintenance follow for the project and the transportation system as a whole. One thing that FDOT and partners have found is that increasing transportation system resiliency is not a linear process, always starting with long-range planning and always ending with operations and maintenance. Instead, we are all figuring out how best to increase resiliency on multiple fronts at the same time. Next slide, please. I'll provide a couple of examples of how FDOT and partners have been increasing resiliency of the transportation system. Waves from Hurricane Sandy passing offshore at high tide led to extensive flooding, a washout, and a lot of sand on a segment of State Road A1 in Fort Lauderdale. Emergency repairs were quickly made to allow access to residents, visitors, and businesses. Next slide, please. Looking longer term, the opportunity to build back stronger and better was recognized by the partners, Fort Lauderdale, Broward County, the Broward MPO, and FDOT. The permanent improvements included making the road more resilient by raising it and installing 1,400 feet of sheet pile to protect from coastal erosion, adjusting the design to repurpose lanes, allowing the incorporation of on-street parking and accommodations for pedestrians and bicyclists, and enhancing the dune system. Although the people involved in this situation were in a reaction rather than a planning mode, there was a positive ending with a more resilient facility meeting the community's vision. Next slide, please. Projects to strengthen the roadway base and protect against coastal erosion on State Road A1A in District 4 are not limited to Fort Lauderdale. Two additional examples are shown here in Palm Beach County and on Hutchinson Island in St. Lucie County. Next slide. Oops, one up. One more up. One more. Oops, other direction, sorry. Okay, next one down, sorry. Well, for whatever slide it's not showing up, we also, another example is FDOT and local governments on or near the coast in Southeast Florida are keenly aware of king tide events and sunny day flooding. And retrofitting efforts started with installation of backflow preventers to stop seawater from flowing into drainage systems as part of maintenance and other projects. So I don't know what I did with the slide, but it had a great picture of backflow preventers, so my apologies there. Moving on, next slide. The question, what is known about vulnerability of transportation infrastructure in Southeast Florida, leads to another question, vulnerable to what? In addition to sea level rise and enhanced storm surge, stressors typically identified by the transportation system in Southeast Florida include a rising water table and saltwater intrusion, increasing precipitation, and increasing temperature. Adding to the stressors are shocks, such as hurricanes. Next slide. Partners in the region have access to a growing body of tools and data relating to transportation infrastructure vulnerability. A related theme is the importance of ensuring they are used in an informed and well-coordinated way. The Sea Level Scenario Sketch Planning Tool is an online geospatial mapping tool to assess potential impacts of flooding on the transportation system. The latest update included adding local roadways, incorporating NOAA 2017 sea level rise projections, and updating base data. The four-county Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compact completed an infrastructure-focused analysis of vulnerability of Southeast Florida to sea level rise in 2012. Broward County completed assessments of the vulnerability of major municipal infrastructure to sea level rise from 12 coastal municipalities. And climate resilience was one of the guiding principles for the 7-county regional vision initiative 750 that concluded in 2014. Next slide. The Broward MPO led the South Florida Climate Change Vulnerability Assessment and Adaptation Pilot Project, that is a mouthful, which focused on the regional transportation network in the four compact counties and was funded by the Federal Highway Administration. The final report on the pilot project includes multiple maps such as future flooding hotspots, adaptive capacity and vulnerability, identifies adaptation-oriented actions that can provide a stronger linkage between climate-related risks and transportation decision-making, and shares lessons learned. As a supplement to the pilot project, FDOT performed work on storm surge, sea level rise, and transportation network disruption using the regional travel demand model and inches of sea level rise in 2040 from the compact's unified sea level rise projection. The Broward MPO completed a follow-up study that determined vulnerability for additional transportation facilities and identified a set of potential projects to improve the long-term resiliency of the transportation system. Miami-Dade County completed an assessment of available tools to create a more resilient transportation system and has done a lot more also, of course. The 3-year South Atlantic Coastal Study, including Florida, is underway. It includes conducting regional analyses of coastal risk and identifying measures and costs that can address reduced vulnerability. Next slide, please. On to the evolution. With changes over time, next slide, please. With changes over time in stormwater requirements, new projects and many major rehabilitation projects require enhanced stormwater handling, including to address sea level rise. The FDOT drainage manual provides direction for FDOT district drainage engineers on incorporation of sea level rise analysis for coastal projects, including construction, reconstruction, and projects rebuilding drainage systems. FDOT monitors federal guidance and sea level rise projection activities. The Florida Department of Environmental Protection is in rulemaking to implement Senate Bill 178 from 2020, which requires completion of sea level impact projection studies, SLIP studies, prior to construction of coastal structures by state-financed constructors. FDOT monitors trends in sea level rise along Florida's coastline, and that includes tracking impacts from king tides in Southeast Florida. Design tools used by FDOT are updated periodically with current rainfall, sea level, and other data. Also, District 4 consults with local government elected officials and public works, engineering, planning, and other staff on involving erosion, drainage, and other such issues. Next slide, please. Another dimension is enhancing the data available for stormwater modeling, preliminary design of transportation projects, and other purposes. The High Resolution Elevation Data Project started as a collaborative pilot study in Broward County using two remote sensing technologies. It evolved into the East Coast Mapping Project, covering a 5-mile swath along 126 miles of coastline from Broward County to Indian River County, and is scheduled to conclude this year. One thing learned along the way is that effective use of high resolution elevation data requires a level of expertise and computer support not available to all partners, increasing the importance of data partnerships. Among the topics covered by ongoing and upcoming FDOT research are transportation system resilience in vulnerable populations, development of a resilience index, incorporating climatic and hydrologic non-stationarity into FDOT planning and design. That's another mouthful, non-stationarity. There's a new word for your vocabulary. And Florida MPO resilience-related data needs. Next slide, please. District 4 has been sharing information on the vulnerability of transportation infrastructure in its reviews of proposed local government comprehensive plan amendments for several years. The comments evolved from providing references to sharing GIS data layers. Another example of more or better data is the Tier 1 risk assessment completed for the South Atlantic Coastal Study. Among other things, it includes a population and infrastructure exposure index, an environment, culture, and habitat exposure index, a social vulnerability index, and also a composite risk index. Broward County has updated its priority planning areas for sea level rise map to reflect the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compact's latest unified sea level rise projection. Average wet season groundwater elevation was the first map adopted in the county's future conditions map series. The second map nearing adoption is the 100-year flood elevation map. Notably, both maps incorporate sea level rise and other factors. Regarding new approaches, one example is the CIRCLE tool, also known as Critical Infrastructure Relations and Consequences for Life and Environment, out of the Netherlands. This tool focuses on cascading impacts of flood events and interdependencies among critical infrastructure systems and brings together various interests and agencies. It has been applied in Broward County. Another new approach is Dynamic Adaptive Policy Pathways, which supports decision-making over time and sequences of decisions or pathways under uncertainty. It supports planners in devising dynamic adaptive plans with short-term actions, long-term options, and adaptation signals. Next slide. And the next slide. This graphic focuses on long-range planning for the transportation system, and in particular, the long-range transportation plans developed for the state and metropolitan areas. These plans have a horizon of at least 20 years. Next slide. The Federal FAST Act added resiliency and reliability to the list of factors state DOTs and MPOs are required to consider as part of their planning processes. The Florida Transportation Plan is a statewide long-range plan guiding Florida's transportation future. It is a plan for all of Florida, created by and providing direction to FDOT and all organizations involved in planning and managing the state's transportation system. Agile, resilient, and quality transportation infrastructure is one of the FTP's goals. The 2020 update of the Florida Freight Mobility and Trade Plan incorporated resilience. Also worth noting is that Florida statutes includes a provision for long-range transportation plans, encouraging MPOs to consider strategies that integrate transportation and land use planning to provide for sustainable development and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Next slide. As in other regions, there are many partners in Southeast Florida involved in transportation planning and decision making. This situation makes collaboration both essential and complicated. And the many partners come with multiple plans. Next slide. Climate action plans are among the plans relevant to transportation planning in Florida, Southeast Florida. The Broward County Climate Action Plan, which includes actions on transportation, is being updated. This slide highlights a sample of recommendations in the Sustainable Communities and Transportation Focus Area in the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compact's Regional Climate Action Plan 2.0. Another type of plan is emerging in Broward County, and it's going to, they're going to be start work this year on a countywide resilience plan. Next slide. As part of research conducted for the latest update of the Florida Transportation Plan, three state universities performed an assessment of planning risks and alternative futures with five areas of inquiry. Those included population, economics, environment, technology, and global issues. Resilience is one of four cross-cutting topics for the update. The FTP policy element, completed last year, has one set of key strategies shown here. For the seven goals of the FTP, also shown here, but not very readable, I apologize. And together, these goals form a vision for the future of transportation in Florida. The first three of the strategies are considered to be foundational. And the aim of this set of key strategies is to identify strategies that can provide the greatest gain, recognizing the seven goals of the Florida Transportation Plan are interconnected and interdependent. That is why they are shown on the slide in the circle. One of the key strategies is to identify and mitigate risk to Florida's transportation systems. Next slide. The 2045 transportation planning cycle for FDOT and the MPOs presented an opportunity to take the next step in integrating resilience into long-range planning. District 4 used results from the sea level scenario sketch planning tool and vulnerability studies and long-range planning for the strategic intermodal system, which is Florida's high-priority network of transportation facilities in Florida for the state's economy. Projects identified by the district for the CIS 2045 multimodal integrated needs plan on vulnerable CIS facilities are tagged, so known or potential vulnerabilities will be considered as tagged projects moved from the needs plan into CIS funding. The district considered resilience in the prioritization and cost estimates for highway projects it proposed for the CIS 2045 cost feasible plan. Three variables from the sea level scenario sketch planning tool were used for risks, storm surge, flood zone, and future sea level. The future sea level risk used was consistent with the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compact's unified sea level rise projection. And then GIS data layers collected or created for this effort are available to the MPOs and other partners. FDOT is in, next slide, please. FDOT is in the second phase of a statewide vulnerability assessment of the strategic intermodal system, which includes development of a resiliency action plan. Next slide. The region's MPOs also made strides on resilience in the 2045 transportation planning cycle. Here are a few highlights. The Southeast Florida Transportation Council, as was indicated earlier, is composed of the Miami-Dade TPO, the Broward MPO, and the Palm Beach TPA. CEFTEC's 2045 Regional Transportation Plan includes objectives supporting efforts of the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compact and promoting both adaptation and growth management strategies to address and increase resilience to coastal and other flooding. The 2045 Long-Range Transportation Plan for the Miami-Dade TPO has a sustainability chapter with vulnerability assessment and other components and objectives on reducing vulnerability and increasing resilience of the transportation system. Next slide, please. The 2045 Metropolitan Transportation Plan for the Broward MTO includes a resiliency objective and performance measures with targets under its strength and communities goal. Includes a sea level rise mitigation and extreme weather resiliency criterion among the evaluation criteria used to prioritize projects. Has a cost feasible plan component that identifies 8 roadway segments based on the South Florida Climate Change Pilot Project I mentioned earlier for further study to identify resiliency improvements. And it also includes a resiliency scenario. The 2045 Long Range Transportation Plan for the Palm Beach TPO identifies targets for performance measures focused on percentages of mileage not resilient to sea level rise and storm surge and annual flooding. Next slide, please. And then regarding studies, wrapping up here shortly. Next slide, please. As the Broward MPO was developing its 2045 Metropolitan Transportation Plan, it asked FDOT what studies to address resilience for projects involving vulnerable transportation facilities cost. District 4 did a national and Florida scan, and not surprisingly, found that there is no single established process or methodology, but rather exploration and application of a variety of approaches leading to projects or project components to increase the resilience of transportation infrastructure. Next slide, please. One of the roadway segments identified for a resiliency study in the Broward MPO's 2045 Metropolitan Transportation Plan is this segment of State Road A1A in Hollywood. The catalyst for the study was recurring flooding. Note teaming partners includes, among others, the FIU Sea Level Solutions Center. The existing conditions and alternative reports have been completed, and FDOT has programmed seawall and pump improvements and is coordinating with partners on funding. Next slide, please. Completed phase one study objectives include identifying flooding locations associated with rainfall events and king tides and establishing existing conditions as a baseline. And then phase two objectives on potential solutions were completed. Work continues on the objectives focused on use of dynamic adaptive policy pathways to determine which recommendations should be implemented and when, and development of cost estimates of possible solutions. Next slide, please. Here are ongoing and next steps. Note in particular, the last two focused on continuing convening of a team of stakeholders and creating an adaptive pathways chart for implementation of recommendations and the emphasis on collaboration. And I know, next slide, please. I threw out a lot of information there, but I'll open it up for questions or discussion.
Are there any raised hands at this time, Margie?
No, Madam Chair.
So thank you so much for that presentation. One of the things that I was in a different conference call before this, and one of the different things that other cities are, considering or other governments considering is looking at budget resiliency. Because I know that right now we're talking about seawater rises, but as we can see in our previous presentations that many communities are being impacted just by COVID. And for us to continue on this path, which I think DOT has done an amazing job of creating all these tools that can really, help us. I was hoping that maybe there are some additional examples of concrete projects that has been constructed as an outcome of these large scale studies. But I do think that one of the things that as DOT moving forward and as part of that presentation is to include a section on budget resiliency and how we can accomplish our goal as, funding is not readily available for these type of projects. I do see that Myron has his hands up. Am I right?
always have my hand up.
Yes, Madam Chair.
It was a lot of information, and I was quite interested in the extent to which tools for analysis are being developed. My impression was that Broward County is a leader in this. To what extent is the Palm Beach TPA collaborating with or learning from the Broward MPO in its approaches to dealing with this problem? We have a lot of resources that are very close to sea level.
Well, the Regional Transportation Technical Advisory Committee is the technical committee for Southeast Board Transportation Council. And that is a forum where the three MPOs do discuss these issues, not just limited to long range planning, but in other ways as well. Broward MPO led that climate pilot project I mentioned that was funded by Federal Highway. And that included participation with Palm Beach MPO and the Miami-Dade MPO in Monroe County. So there are various people stepping up to take the lead on things, and there are resources to use in planning. And as I mentioned, we're learning as we go along. Start with long range planning, you don't always get to start there and go all the way to operations and maintenance. It's doing what you can at different on different fronts at the same time. But the MPOs are discussing this together. They've done studies together. There are tools that they can use together. I think we're in Broward County asking a question about if something has a known or potential vulnerability, doing a study or whatever, how much does that cost? What do you do next? So there's no just one path at this point. I think a lot of agencies, a lot of other entities are learning along the way. An important thing is to share. And I think in terms of concrete projects to that question, I wanted to share that State Road 818 tidal flooding study, because that's an example of a state facility amongst communities that have side streets that flood as well as A1A, or even more than A1A. And shared interest in drainage, or is there a continuous seawall, and there's just these, I heard the word holistic solutions said earlier in another context, but this is something that requires holistic solutions and novel thinking, bringing in the FIU Sea Level Solutions Center. And it's Obi, don't ask me to pronounce his name, who is the director there, who has been sharing information on this dynamic adaptive policy pathways approach I mentioned, which allows you to take action in uncertain conditions, under uncertainty, but start with pumps and seawalls, for example, not necessarily elevating a road, or ultimately the land use has to be harmonized with the roads and all of those kind of conversations. So with new approaches, new tools that can help you understand what may or may not be inundated under certain assumptions related to sea level rise projections. So we're getting more and more equipped to address these issues. And importantly, as a group of partners, because there's not just one transportation facility in isolation, it's a transportation system tied to land uses that depend on it. Stormwater management systems, integrating those sorts of things. It's, I would say, never a dull moment, but definitely a lot of work and thought. And back to the Florida Transportation Plan and that goal of agile, resilient, and quality infrastructure, integrating resilience into all the things that various partners do. Not limited to FDOT or MPOs or local governments, it's everyone working together.
Thank you. There's a great deal to think about.
And one other thing, another type of these projects kind of evolve. There's back to State Road A1A in Hollywood, there was a resurfacing project. And FDOT added to that in terms of lining drainage pipes and installing backflow preventers and so forth as part of that resurfacing project and enhancing the drainage to the extent possible and putting the electrical and light poles up to the middle of the pole, not at the base of the pole. And the Community Redevelopment Agency put money into improved multimodal aspects of the roadway. So these are, that was a resurfacing project that had these add-ons. And it had a resilience component as well as a mobility component. So it's not a one type of project. It's not just resilience projects, other projects. Many projects may end up having resilience components. And to your question about the budgetary part, and I would say the FTP, and I give the Board of Transportation Plan credit for this, when they talk about resiliency, it's not just to environmental types of risk, it's to economic and social risk, and you can throw in budgetary risk. But the, and we did some research into what are best and emerging practices for state DOTs, and the theme is you integrate this into all you do for adaptation, all the things DOT does. But really an evolving area with where there is not a lot of information yet or track record is financing these. So again, another area to learn. And if you're interested in that subject and you haven't looked at it, Southeast Florida came up with a business plan, a business case for resilience. It was led by Urban Land Institute. It came out several months ago, but they found a 4-to-1 return on investment for and so forth that came out of the business community, making a business case for resilience and taking steps in that direction. So there are a lot there, and if there are particular things you want additional information on, I'm glad to provide it.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the great presentation. So we are going to move to item C, the TPA community profile dashboard. James?
I had some questions. I can't find a hand raising button.
Yeah, no problem.
Can I talk to Laura Bush or Lois Bush?
Lois Bush, I believe she's still on.
I'm still here. I just wanted to spare you all. I haven't been to a hair salon in a year, so.
Okay. First of all, what's your background? Is it civil engineering, planning, or something else?
My background is in urban and regional planning, so I'm on the planning side of things. Work in an agency with a lot of engineers, so I've learned a lot about the engineers.
Okay, well, my question is kind of engineering. Is in school, I was taught ferroconcrete building stuff are designed to last like 50 years because, you know, they rust out. So my question was, is there any look to stuff like basalt rebar, which could use in salt water, could last for, you know, 100 or hundreds of years? And in building, like rebuilding some of this stuff, is there any looking towards the future that, you know, sea level rise is going to continue? So is there any design going into the projects now where you can add 2 feet in 30 years or something?
Well, I think the materials used is another part of this whole, how do we adapt to changing conditions? And in Broward County, they have a model that showed that USGS prepared for the interaction of surface and groundwater that showed pretty far inland, 1 foot of sea level rise with 1 foot of rise of groundwater. So you're talking about roadbeds, materials, so forth, having exposures they haven't had historically, and how do you handle those things?
Well, my question is, the stuff that was built recently in A1A, is it going to have to be torn up 100% in 20 years and redone to add another 6 inches or a foot? Or is it designed so it can easily be added onto for another foot or so?
Well, I think that's a conversation in terms of what's your time frame and how long you want to go out for. That dynamic adaptive policy pathways is an example of pumps and seawalls before elevation. And then over time, what you do there or don't do there may well evolve. But there are various places where there has been elevation of roads going in, Miami Beach and places in District 4 and likely elsewhere.
For how many feet? How many feet are you counting on sea level rise occurring?
Well, that tidal flooding study I mentioned, they are using the unified sea level rise projection from Southeast Florida to identify what potential solutions may be over some time frame. But you don't start out building the Cadillac if you ever end up doing so. Cost prohibitive.
Okay, well, what's your timeline? What do you think the sea level rise is going to be? What's FDOT figuring sea level rise is going to be in 50 years?
Can you go back to the slide that shows that there's a slide on the climate action plans that shows the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compacts, Unified Sea Level Rise?
No, that's okay. How long do you think it's going to take to rise a foot? How long is it going to take to rise to 2 foot? What's FDOT planning for that?
FDOT, the drainage manual, currently is looking at historical trends, but they're revisiting the drainage manual in terms of what's looked at. But if you look on the lower right-hand corner, particularly if you're looking longer term, this is the projection, the latest projection of Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compact. So in 27, you're seeing a range of, can someone read that better than I, 23 to 27. Well, you can see the range.
My screen reads, so I don't know.
So it depends on the purpose. The tidal flooding study I mentioned looked at what is the projected sea level rise based on this projection for the Southeast Florida region. FDOT does not have a set per se of here are the sea level rise projections. We do have a sea level scenario sketch planning tool, which includes a number of scenarios which you can test.
Okay, well, what it sounds like to me, there's no plan to start putting down a foundation to last 100 years or 200 years. That's so basically everything that's going to be built now is going to be torn up in 20 to 30 years and rebuilt. Right?
I'm not sure if Lois has the answer to that question.
Okay. My other question then is Hurricane Dorian. 48 hours before it did a little jog and took out the Bahamas, it was headed basically straight for the Boynton Beach Inlet. So does FDOT have any information on what would have happened had it continued on track for another 48 hours? Basically, how would I find out what would have been the storm surge in the area had it made landfall as projected at that time? You know, 10 feet, 15 feet. And a related question to that, what kind of resilience does FDOT have if an event like that occurs in Palm Beach County? How long would it take to get I-95 open again? Those two questions. How high the storm surge? How long to reopen I-95 after such a hurricane event?
Well, I will ask, I know they did a lot of studies after Irma in terms of that evacuation. That CIS vulnerability assessment, the statewide CIS vulnerability assessment I mentioned, that looked at highways and flooding. So there are results there that give a sense of vulnerability. And that the second phase of that study is going to be a resiliency action plan. So that would be something that would be addressed through trying to do a resiliency action plan.
From my knowledge and from my understanding of how, especially during hurricanes in general, how all roads are determined to be closed, it's a collaborative effort at the EOC, and that's usually whoever is the commander is usually the chief of police or the fire department chief, somebody that makes those decisions, make those calls from a life safety standpoint. I'm not sure if DOT is a collaborator, so I'm not sure if Lois will have the answer to that question.
Okay, is I-95 in this area designed to take a 15-foot storm surge a mile from the coast?
I don't know the answer to that specific question, but I can certainly ask.
Okay. Yeah.
I can share that study. We did that study of sea level rise storm surge and transportation network disruption. And that looked at three hurricanes, Andrew, one that came in at Delray Beach, and one that came in at Fort Lauderdale. And there was water modeling and so forth, and it looked at surge. So if you're interested in seeing that report, I'd be glad to share it. That'll give you a sense of how sea level rise plus surge can affect disrupt the transportation network. That might move in that direction.
Okay, I'll send an email. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you so much. We do have two items left on the agenda. You know, we can either defer it to the next meeting, or if it's something that we think that we can continue at this time. I believe, based on our agenda, when are we scheduled to adjourn, Margie?
It is generally, the meetings are about 2 hours, but if the committee wants to run longer, it's up to the committee members. But I did have a few members leave, and at some point you will lose your quorum.
Sure. So why don't we, do we need a motion to adjourn early and defer the other two items?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. So knowing that other members have to drop off and respect time for everybody, can I get a motion to defer the other additional two items that's on the agenda and end the meeting early?
I'll make that motion.
Okay. Can I have a second?
Second.
Okay, thank you. So for a minute there, I thought we were all very interested to stay until a little longer, but we have a motion and a second. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All those oppose, nay. Okay, seeing none, I guess meeting's adjourned. Margie, do you need anything from me?
No, Madam Chair. I will note for the committee that the next meeting is April 7th.
Okay. Thank you so much. Have a good day, everybody.